Why have I asked my electrician I found on Angie.com to bury my pet hamster Nibbles in our yard for me? Because I was so moved by how carefully he buried my electrical wires, I knew I could trust him to bury my sweet Nibbles after his untimely end. Huh, Nibbles. Gone too soon. May he scurry in peace.
Hey, sorry about your pet, but I just wire stuff.
Nibbles would have loved you like a brother.
Connecting homeowners with skilled pros for over 30 years. Angie, the one you trust to find the ones you trust. Find pros for all your home projects at Angie.com.
Let's be serious here. For months, the number of Australians either fighting with or supporting ISIS, estimated at around 150 to 200. Today's suggestion is that up to 400 might be involved, either fighting with Islamic State or supporting them here at home. This is a quote in the Telegraph from a senior intelligence figure that's really upped the ante on the numbers involved. Perhaps more disturbingly, they are saying that up to 30 or 40 Australian jihadists have somehow managed to slip back into the country. It is a real concern. If you think of the Charlie Hebdo attacks, they were both trained by jihadists overseas before they slipped back into France. So how is this possible? And what sort of tabs are we keeping on these people? Greg Barton's the Director International of Global Terrorism Research Centre at Monash University. He's on the line. Professor Barton, thanks for your time again.
Thanks. Good to speak with you again.
Professor, 40 Australian jihadists now rumoured to have slipped back into the country. That's grounds for concern, isn't it?
Oh, it certainly is. And, you know, it begs the question why they're not prosecuted. The reality is, and this is not something we have on our own in Australia, it's true all around the world, it's very hard to get the evidence together to present before judge and jury that can secure prosecutions. It's one thing for our intelligence agencies to know somebody has been with foreign fighters and have concerns. It's another thing to present that evidence in a court of law. Getting that sort of evidence out of Iraq and Syria at the moment, it's very, very hard, and it's just a very big challenge. So we shouldn't downplay it. But
why do you think that the number of these suspected jihadists and their sympathisers has been revised upwards?
I'm not sure that it has been revised upwards. We're just these are in some ways not new numbers. It's just that we're sort of having a fresh look at them. We've long been told that there were 70, 80 people fighting with Islamic State or other jihadi groups in Iraq and Syria. Lately, that has been revised a little bit upwards to sort of around 90. We're told that a quarter of those who have gone have been killed in combat, and that a similar number have come back. So that gives us people who have been directly involved in the order of 160. But then, of course, the support base, people who are facilitating their travel and who are sponsoring it and who would otherwise are getting behind it, you know, that would put the number in the order of, you know, of around 400, as Telegraph was saying today. So in a way, that's not new. But, of course, when we think back at what happened in Paris a couple of weeks ago, it does bring home in a fresh way the sort of magnitude of the challenge we're facing.
Would you say that we're now at a greater risk of a coordinated terror attack here because there are more of these people back in the country?
Yes, we are. I think that it's probably fair to assume that what's happening in Europe is a bit of a leading indicator, that we're still a little bit behind on that. But we can see the sort of challenges we could be facing looking at Europe. And, of course, before the Paris attacks, we had Mehdi Nemush go into a Jewish museum middle of last year and shoot dead four people. And 2 years earlier, Mohammed Mera, you know, both these young men, like the Kawachi brothers, had returned from foreign fighting. Mohammed Mera went on a rampage over 10 days and shot dead seven people, including young children at point-blank range. And we haven't seen that sort of thing happen in Australia yet. We got a horrible taste of it with Marn Monis in Sydney, but in many ways he was a rank amateur compared with these guys. But that's what we've got to plan and prepare for now.
We've got reports today, particularly in the Australian newspaper, suggesting that some of the convicted terrorist plotters from about 10 years ago, who have been in Goulburn Maximum Security Prison and others, are now trying to reach out and influence a new generation of Islamic State devotees. How concerning is that?
That's extremely concerning. That's perhaps one of the most disturbing aspects of the threat we're facing, and that Operation Penindus, back the arrests were made November 2005, was the biggest counter-terrorism operation ever, certainly the most expensive court trials in Sydney and in Melbourne. And we had some people like Mohammed El Omar Sr. sentenced to 28 years in prison. This is people who didn't get a chance to execute their attacks, so you can imagine the sort of evidence they had against them. And yet, the ringleaders at the core of this, Ben Brinker, Mohammed El Omar, the Cheko boys, the Rudd boys, These guys seem completely unrepentant, and they've passed on their radicalism to the next generation. So Muhammad El Omar Sr. influenced his nephew, Muhammad El Omar Jr., to go off with Khalid. Mm. Of course, Khalid Sharif was sentenced to a shorter sentence because of his role in the Sydney cell not being so clear. But we're seeing this horrible pattern where even if you prosecute elaborate police operation, expensive court trial, prosecute, put people in maximum security jail, you can't necessarily stop them having an influence.
Yep. All right, Professor, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Pleasure, thanks very much.
Professor Greg Barton, so I find these stories really frustrating because we're enunciating a problem which is getting deeper, but there isn't really an easy answer to it that's going to bring it to any obvious conclusion in the short term.
No, except as we keep discussing it, the numbers get bigger and bigger and bigger, and therefore the chances of something really awful happening in this country are also increasing.
And you worry about the future. You look at your kids and you think, well, what sort of world are they growing into?
And meanwhile, we're still waiting for some of the members of the Islamic community to stand up and really force a big crackdown on fundamentalism.
Hi, I'm Angie Hicks, co-founder of Angie. When you use Angie for your home projects, you know all your jobs will be done well. Roof repair? Done well. Kitchen sink install? Done well. Deck upgrades? Done well. Electrical upgrade? Done well. Angie's been connecting homeowners with skilled pros for nearly 30 years, so we know the difference between done and done well.
Angie, the one you trust to find the ones you trust. Find a pro for your project at Angie.com.
Hi everyone, this is James and Dan. We are two-fourths of the hit UK podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. Every week we sit down behind some microphones and share with each other the best things we've found out over the last 7 days.
Yes, so for instance, Dan, did you know that you cannot tie a knot in four dimensions?
I knew that's where I was going wrong. Interesting.
There are all sorts of reasons why, but we would go into them all on our podcast, along with loads of extra facts as well.
That's right. And if you want to check it out, No Such Thing as a Fish is available wherever you get your podcasts.